Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The election is in just 19 days. With so much at stake, we are talking about the fight for the U.S. Senate. 34 Senate seats are on the ballot, but only a handful or so are expected to play a key role. Democrats hold 51 seats to the Republicans' 49. Republicans will most likely win the seat vacated by Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, which would split control of the Senate down the middle. Critical legislation affecting issues like gun control and abortion and key judicial confirmations are on the line. We might even have another U.S. Supreme Court nomination. Joining us to talk about this is John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. John has written, co-written, or edited over a dozen books on topics like the histories of U.S. socialism and the Democratic Party and the U.S. and global media systems. His latest book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Hi, John. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. It is a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's always great to have you, John. I want to ask you a big but very important question to begin with, because you've been doing this for so long. Donald Trump has said just outrageous things on the campaign trail. This is not new. We could spend hours talking about this. Yesterday, he was interviewed on Fox for a town hall in front of women. And the host said that the family of Amber Thurman, this is the young 28-year-old who tragically died because of an extreme abortion ban, a Republican ban in Georgia. Now, she didn't get the urgent care that she needed. And the Fox host said, the family is speaking ahead of this town hall. Trump's response, and I'm not even going to play the clip, he said, we will get better ratings, I promise. I mean, the things he says are so brutal, and none of this is new, but it's just coming at us constantly. John, why do you think, if the polls are correct, that this race is so close? We don't know that, but we do know that he's going to get tens of millions of votes. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, there are several answers, and I could go in many directions, but because you, Rose, and I have spent so many years talking about our media system, I think your audience will be very aware of something that I'll focus in on. And that is that our media system, as we knew it, collapsed. It's dead. Local media across the United States, it played an incredible role in balancing our politics and, frankly, calling out national leaders in the language, the parlance, the resonating terms of regions across the country. That local media has collapsed. Daily newspapers are non-existent or a shell of their former selves. Tens of thousands of journalists have been laid off. The rise of social media has not filled the gap. Instead, we've seen the creation of platforms which amplify propaganda, sometimes amplify spin or just plain political arguments. It doesn't mean there's not good stuff on social media, but it does mean there's just an awful lot of you know, false premises out there. And into this has come cable news, and cable news has chosen to be partisan, or at least to be aligned with particular partisan camps. And all of this has added up to a situation where people now get their information very much in a silo. And so they're constantly reinforced in certain views. What that has created is a situation where Donald Trump can say the most outrageous things imaginable. And even where people may think that that is outrageous, Trump supporters may think, whoa, that sounds pretty out there. That's kind of cruel. They have become so acculturated, you know, they've become so used to it that they don't take it seriously, or if they do take it seriously, they actually like it. They see him as some sort of, you know, person is willing to say the blunt, unpleasant things that others are not willing to say. And so we get into this situation now where just this week, Trump has said a dozen things that would have disqualified Dwight Eisenhower or Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon or Gerald Ford or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. You know what I mean? It's like these things would have been absolutely disqualifying. Trump the other day said about auto workers, he compared them to children. He said the work they do could be done by children. I mean, that would have been the end of a campaign for Gerald Ford or for Jimmy Carter, not 50 years ago. But we live in a different media system. We live in a different circumstance. And our media, the people who practice journalism, have to catch up to this reality. They have to recognize, you know, what has happened. And frankly, until they do, until they recognize that there needs to be a renewal of a lot of our media systems, a renewal of journalism in this country in a very combative, very aggressive, very bold way that calls out lies and that doesn't let go of them, doesn't fall into the trap of both-siderism. Until we do that, this is our reality. This is our circumstance, and Donald Trump is the face of it. Mm.
Well, we definitely want to have you on a Friday show, John, because I think we also, it's so important to talk about the changing media landscape. Mm-hmm. And we're thinking about this on a daily basis. I've been struck by the podcast that Kamala Harris has gone on, and I've never heard of these podcasts, and they've got millions of followers. And it's so
they filled the void.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's so mm-hmm. interesting. Like young women, I think it's Call Her Daddy.
Yep.
I think that's it. I never heard of that. And yet I went on the host's Instagram. She's got so many followers and she's young. And it's just, it's almost head spinning how fast things have changed.
Well, I'll give you an example. A very good friend of mine for very many years, a guy named George Gale. He's one of the handful of truly great organizers in America. He led a group called People's Action. Now he works in a lot of different areas. He was telling me the other day about a woman, a mother, I think in the Carolinas, who's on Reddit and has something like 50,000 single moms organized.
Wow.
And communicates to them on a regular basis about issues relating to politics. And you understand, that's a whole new zone. If I was running a campaign, I might advise a candidate to go, you know, join that person on a Facebook Live, because they may be connecting to more folks than a cable show. And so once we start to understand this new media landscape, it begins to make sense. We may not like it, but we can begin to recognize how it works. And the reason I focus in on this is because in 2016, Donald Trump became president of the United States because he understood the media landscape as it existed at that point. And so he did a combination of old media and new media. He was calling into MSNBC and calling into Fox and appearing on all sorts of broadcasts and cable shows. But he was also using his Twitter feed as a vehicle to make sure that his message got out, to make it heard. And frankly, media was covering what he tweeted. So he recognized how to use the whole of that media landscape to a far greater extent than other candidates that year, including Hillary Clinton. It's one of the main reasons he's president. The interesting question of 2024 is, does Kamala Harris recognize the media system of today? And is she the candidate who has figured out how to reach the right platforms, go to the right places, do the right things? And might that ultimately be the explanation if indeed she does win?
And John, just one more thing on this, because you've spent so much time writing about the media. So Alex Cooper, the host of Call Her Daddy, has mm-hmm. 2.4 million followers on Instagram. In August, she signed a $125 million deal with Sirius XM. So I think this is another part of media that we need to spend more time talking about. While so many journalists are losing their jobs and outlets are shutting down, you have this young woman who's got this very popular podcast that most of us probably have not heard of until Kamala Harris did this interview, and she signs a $125 million deal with Sirius XM.
It's amazing. And it tells us two things, two important things, Rose. Number one, the money's out there. The money for journalism, the money for media is out there. It exists. It's not like everything dried up because, there's just some people kind of weak thinking. I think theorists will say, oh, well, the internet just gives you everything for free. And so, it's created this new economics. No, we still have people, with a lot of money who are paying folks to create content. What we used to call news, what we now call content, however you want to refer to it. Bottom line, the money is out there. And the host of Call Your Daddy, right? That, what she's figured out a way to enter into this system and succeed. More power to her. Nothing wrong with that. And remember, people did that in the past, right? Popular radio hosts and popular TV hosts. So that's somebody figuring out the media system as it exists today. Right. Don't falter for it. Understand that's our reality.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I'm checking out her podcast, and she's filling a void, and so many young women are listening to her. It's just fascinating, and I just think we've only scratched the surface of what.
So let me give
means.
You. You're so right, and I promise you, I know we're going to talk about the Senate. Let me give you one last twist on this that you'll just. I know you'll respect, Rose, because you know this material so well, and you could write a book on it. Yeah, so. There's a guy named Martin Ware who was in the band Heaven 17 back in the 80s, 90s, a remarkably talented musician. And he has a show in England, mostly in England, called Electronically Yours. It's a podcast, right? He brings politicians on, takes them through deep examinations of their cultural thinking, their music they like. People like Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the Labour Party, coming on and talk about cultural issues and stuff, then leads them into a discussion about how that compares to their politics. And it's highly engaging. There are tons of listeners. And who is to say that what Martin Ware is doing isn't a better way of doing, and I'll use the word, journalism,
right?
Examining candidates, examining. He does, most of his guests are musicians. He'd be very blunt about that. But when he has politicians on, it's great. And I listen to it all the time because you see people being brought out of their shells and revealing things about how they became who they are. And isn't that often what we're looking for in our politics, right? We're trying to figure out whether we can trust a politician. Well, here, Martin Ware, in my view, has figured out a way to do it, that's very effective. And so I'm as good as anybody at seeing dystopia and seeing this moment as the worst possible moment and everything falling apart and going to hell. And in many ways it is. But I will tell you, there's also things happening out there that are flat out fascinating and that may be opening up media in new ways. And we shouldn't just dismiss it all.
Right, exactly. Today we're speaking with John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. We'll definitely have John back before the election to talk about this very fast-moving media landscape. Now we're going to talk about the U.S. Senate. If you have any questions or comments for John, he has written books about all of this. He's spent so much time focusing on these issues. What races are you watching? Because, of course, we know the Senate is so critical for issues like gun control and abortion, of course, but then judicial confirmations, we might have another U.S. Supreme Court nomination. John, can you talk about this? And I always watch to see who is mentioning the Senate on the campaign trail. Kamala Harris is mentioning it a bit, but I'm not hearing her talk about it as much as you would think. Are you hearing her talk about it?
A little bit. And I'm hearing Trump do it a little bit. He does it when he's appearing with a candidate. But the fact is that Harris needs to talk about it a lot more. It's an absurdity to let this reality stay on the sidelines politically. That's true for our media, too. I mean, if you watch cable channels, and I appear on these channels, and so I'm not, I'm honored when they invite me to come talk. But I've got to tell you that the overwhelming discussion is about the presidential race. It's like 100-1. And the problem is that the founders of this country, imperfect as they were, set up a system of shared governance. We don't have a British style system. We don't have a German style system where if a party wins, they then form a government, right? We have a system where one party can hold the executive branch, another party can hold the legislative branch, and they both, to some extent, although Trump has overwhelmingly done this, define the judicial branch. And so you can't look at an election just through the presidency. It's madness to do so. And yet I see that in our media, and I also see that in a lot of our political class. And so to go to your core question, though, Rose, which is the essential one. First off, we understand why the Senate matters. I can do it in two sentences. If Donald Trump is elected president of the United States and gets a Republican Senate, he will be able to implement vast sections of Project 2025, mm-hmm. right? We worry about Project 2025. We talk about it. We talk about other things Trump has said and done. If he gets the presidency and control of the Senate, his ability to kind of run roughshod becomes overwhelming, because it's through the Senate you appoint cabinet members, thus you can reshape the federal government, and you get judges. So there you go. Flip side, if Kamala Harris comes in with a Democratic Senate and with a House, and I think the House may well go Democratic this year, if she comes in with a Democratic Senate, all the promises, all the things she talks about in the campaign trail have the potential to become real, because we're in an evolved politics where people now understand that the Senate filibuster has to be done away with. I think Harris herself understands that. And so her ability to govern becomes exponentially greater. But then there is this final possibility. If Harris becomes president with a Republican Senate, which, by the way, right now is probably the most likely bet, right? If she becomes president with a Republican Senate in the dynamic that we exist in now, her ability to govern will be little better than that of a lame duck president from day one. Now, that's something, you know, that should be chilling to people if they like Harris. If they dislike her, maybe they'll like that. But that's the important thing to understand. And so the Senate becomes absolutely critical. And you ask me what races I'm watching. Look, we can go through them in a deeper way and talk about individual ones because they're fascinating. But of course, I'm watching the reality that the Republicans have the advantage in this cycle because it comes off the 2018 cycle that was very good for Democrats. So you have a lot of Democrats who are in battleground states, even in Republican-leaning states, who are running for re-election. So you're looking at these incumbents as being vulnerable. The ones I would talk about, of course, first and foremost on the vulnerability scale, are John Tester in Montana. A relatively progressive Democrat who has voted not perfectly on everything. I mean, people find things subjective, but the fact is he's backed Democratic court picks. He's opposed Republican court picks. He's been a pretty responsible Democratic senator. He is in a very tough race. Sherrod Brown in Ohio, another state that's likely to vote for Trump. Very progressive, actually, Democratic senator. Really in a tough fight, although he seems to be holding on. Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, a great battleground state, a classic battleground state. She seems to be a little ahead. Open seat in Michigan. There you've got a Democrat and a Republican, both strong, very, very close race. Bob Casey running over in Pennsylvania, looks like he'll pull it off. And then a key thing to go is down into Arizona. And there you've got the race to fill the seat that was Kyrsten Sinema, and the Democrat running in that seat, Ruben Gallegos, seems to be ahead a little bit of Kerry Lake, one of the great Trump allies, but that's a very, very tight race. So we've just gone over a little bit of a map, not a full one. One final codicil I'll just throw in.
Yeah.
In West Virginia, the Democrats are almost certain to lose a seat.
Right.
Right now, their majority they have a 51-49 majority. Losing the West Virginia seat takes you to 50-50. So when I just went over that whole map of different places, if one of those Democrats out there loses in Arizona or in Michigan or in Montana, one of them loses, and the Democrats don't pick something up someplace else, which is a tough fight, the Republicans have the Senate.
John, one of the things I've been thinking about, and of course we don't know, I think that women are so angry about what happened with Roe that anything is possible at this point.
Mm-hmm. 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 You are so right.
I think a lot of women are going to be voting for the very first time, because it's so easy to forget that almost half the country does not vote. Mm-hmm. And so I think that Roe has just made so many people angry who've never been in politics before. I mean, you hear these devastating stories about women who need abortions. They don't even know that abortion is illegal in their state. I just feel like we live in such a political bubble, those of us who are junkies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are just struggling to get by. They've got multiple jobs. They're taking care of their kids. And they don't follow this stuff. And people didn't see Roe coming, and they do not know that abortion is illegal in their state or very hard to get until they go to the clinic.
So let me 100% agree with you. Put in one sentence that just says, and a lot of that relates to the collapse of local media, something we were talking about before.
Right.
And then go into something that will blow your mind to an even greater extent. How many people come into the potential pool of voters every year, every few years? There are millions, tens of millions of voters who weren't old enough to vote in 2016.
Right.
Right? Who are old enough to vote now. They happen to be exactly in the age demographic, you know, the 20s, where one would think that abortion would be a particularly resonant issue, right? And, you know, pollsters don't even often know how to get near these folks. Mm. They're getting better at it. The pollsters are getting better at it. But you understand, these are folks who weren't voters, right? They're in a group that historically has been written off by a lot of pollsters as unlikely voters. They don't use traditional phones. You know what I mean? So here you have all these millions of people who could theoretically, inspired by Kamala Harris, inspired by the decision in Dobbs, inspired by a Senate race, inspired by any number of other things, step into the electorate. They have the absolute potential to make this election, you know, not just a win for the Democrats, but for potentially a major victory, one that gives Harris a governing majority. And I want to emphasize, those people don't just vote on the issue of choice. They vote on a lot of other issues. Many of them are deeply concerned about Gaza. And so there's complexities there.
Right.
But this is why what you're saying is so very, very true. We don't know how this is going to turn out. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is power. And power is always at play, right? You know, economic and political power, and it is an organized reality. It may divide into camps, but it exists. Power has recognized the reality of the Senate races. And so as a result, these Senate races, which used to be, in my time of covering things, used to be decided for a candidate who spent $4 or $5 million, these races are now, we're looking at $70, $80, $90, $100 million. I just did a piece on the Texas race. Colin Allred, who's a very impressive candidate who does seem to be rising in his race against Ted Cruz, but he hasn't been at the top of the list. He hasn't been the most paid attention to. He just raised $70 million, he and his supporters and allies, $70 million.
Wow.
So you understand what I'm saying is all of these things make the Senate races, A, super important. Power doesn't lie. It may lie to you, but it doesn't lie to itself. They know where you know, economic and political interests know where the future is defined. And that's why they're pouring all this money into the Senate races. And secondly, I think they're doing so because it's so volatile. You really don't know how it's going to turn out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obscene amounts of money. We'll definitely do a money in politics show. We're going to play, or we're going to go to a quick break, and then we have a lot of clips from a lot of the Senate debates that we want to play.
Excellent.
In the second half of the show. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of many books, including his New York Times bestseller. He wrote it with Senator Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Today, we're talking about the fight for the U.S. Senate. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the fight for the U.S. Senate with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's written many best-selling books. You can find more information about John's work at kalw.org. Click news and then Your Call. So we've got a lot of clips, John. Since you brought up the Montana race, Let's talk about this one. Tim Sheehy, a lot of people are just learning about him. He's very young. Mm-hmm. He's only 38. He's a former Navy SEAL who's running as a Republican. He's done some events with Donald Trump. He's got a lot of money. According to the Montana Free Press, he's the CEO of Belgrade. It's an aerial firefighting company called Bridger Aerospace. He earns about $7 million a year in non-investment income. $5 million comes from his salary. His total net worth is about $74 to $200 million. This would make him one of the wealthiest members of Congress if he is elected. A lot of people have pointed to his previous record of owning luxury properties in Montana. So I want to play this clip, which deserves a lot more attention. Tim Sheehy was caught on tape at a fundraising event last year making racist comments about Native Americans in Montana. Natives make up 7% of Montana's population. First, he says members of the Crow tribe are drunk at 8 o'clock in the morning. This clip is from KTVQ News.
And I grew up in Grand with them every year, you know, down there. So, great way to bond with all the Indians to be out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m. and you're roping together.
That comment is a stereotype that Crow Tribe Secretary Levi Black Eagle finds insensitive.
I think that it's a perpetuating old racist stereotypes, that of the outdated idea that the drunken Indian.
Just days after that initial recording, Sheehy was caught on tape yet again at another event, this time accusing tribal members of throwing beer cans at him.
And I tell you, if you don't make that double heel shot on the res, you know, the Coors Light can's flying inside of him. You know, they let you know right away. Hey, yeah, nice shot, man. So it's a tough crowd.
Then I don't think that there's ever been an instance where one of the spectators threw anything, especially at one of our guests. We treat our guests better than that.
So you heard people laughing when he said that Native people were throwing beer cans at him. In case you didn't hear the first comment that he said last year, he said, I rope and brand with them, talking about the Crow tribe every year. So it's a great way to bond with all the Indians out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m. So here is Democratic Senator John Tester during a recent debate calling out Tim Sheehy for those racist comments.
Tim, if you really feel this way about Native Americans, you ought to apologize for the statements you made about them that were totally inaccurate, but yet you won't. And you're going to say they were cut up or taken out of form. Look, that's on tape once again, and you didn't think anybody was listening, but believe people when they say stuff in a back room.
Mr. Sheehy.
Well, the back room was a gathering with about, I don't know, five dozen people there. But the reality is, insensitive. I come from the military, as many of our tribal members do. You know, we make insensitive jokes and probably off color sometimes. And you know, I'm an adult. I'll take accountability for that. But let's not distract from the issues that our tribal communities are suffering. The border bill that I wasn't even able to vote on didn't pass. And the border's been wide open on the Democrats' watch.
So Tim Sheehy refused to apologize. I mean, this is just horrible, John. I mean, he says it's just, you know, this is what you hear when you're in the military. And this guy could possibly beat John Tester and become a U.S. senator.
I would say the betting right now is that he will beat John Tester and become senator. That could change. I mean, I'm strongly in the camp that believes that politics is constantly evolving. And so races can get closer and you know, more distant. But at this point, you know, Sheehy is ahead, at least in a lot of the polling. And what's amazing about what you just played there was he managed to insult both indigenous peoples and the military,
right?
In the same sense, right. Which is pretty incredible. And I can tell you this again: we were talking about this in the presidential race. Statements like this would have been disqualifying not that long ago, but Montana's seen a collapse in a lot of its local media and so this campaign is running overwhelmingly on TV ads, right? And Sheehy has flooded the zone with TV ads. I mean, they're spending so much money in Montana that it's jaw-dropping. Tens and tens of millions of dollars in a relatively small population state. Sheehy has also said that women have been, quote-unquote, indoctrinated about abortion, right? And like as if women can't make up their own minds and what they think about the issue of reproductive rights. And so he's got a long list of what historically, again, using that word historically, would have been disqualifying statements. Now he's a very viable candidate. As you heard, he's very slick. You know, he's good at kind of taking a tough question and turning it, you know, to his favor. John Tester is more old school. I mean, he's born and raised multi-generational Montana, coming out of a small farm that he has worked his whole life. You know, this is a guy who actually goes home on the weekend from the Senate and works in the fields. He's out on the tractor. He is a politician of a certain age, of a certain time in American politics. And it really is a question whether someone like this can survive politically. Mm-hmm. He's a very honorable man. I've known him for a long, long time. He's quite a remarkable figure. But he's in a tough, tough race. And the last thing I'll say about Montana that's fascinating, and this is really kind of amazing. He's not from Montana. He's from Minnesota. He grew up, born and raised in a wealthy suburb of the Twin Cities. He moved to Montana, like a lot of rich people, because it's a really beautiful place, and he bought up land and luxury, you know, locations to live in because he wanted to look at mountains, you know, from his, you know, mansion. That's who he is. There's a lot of discomfort with that in Montana, you know, from working class people who live there a long time. And yet, even with that reality, the fact that there's a, you know, multi-generational Montanan running against a guy from Minnesota, because of how our politics has changed with the influence of money, the collapse of traditional media, all sorts of other factors, such a person can be viable.
Okay, so that's Montana. Let's talk about Texas. You brought this up earlier, and you just came out with a piece today called Ted Cruz is Just as Hapless and Maybe Just as Beatable as Donald Trump. So Ted Cruz and Colin Allred recently had a debate. Before we ask you to weigh in on this, I want to play a few clips because abortion played a pretty significant role at this debate. But for some context, of course, Texas was one of the first states that passed an extreme ban. And so many brave women have shared their stories as a result. At the 2024 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Texas abortion advocates Amanda and her husband Josh Zorowski shared their story of being refused an abortion despite Amanda carrying an unviable fetus.
Every time I share our story, my heart breaks. For the baby girl we wanted desperately, for the doctors and nurses who couldn't help me deliver her safely. For Josh, who feared he would lose me too. But I was lucky. I lived. So I'll continue sharing our story, standing with women and families across the country. Today, because of Donald Trump, more than one in three women of reproductive age in America lives under an abortion ban. A second Trump term would rip away even more of our rights. Passing a national abortion ban, letting states monitor pregnancies and prosecute doctors, restricting birth control and fertility treatments. We cannot let that happen. We need to vote as if lives depend on it, because they do.
So that was Amanda Zorowski speaking at the National Democratic Convention. Here is Kate Cox in an ad for Colin Allred.
Our house has constant reminders. Two sippy cups, two high chairs, two stuffed animals. But there should have been three. I was driving home from work when I got a phone call from my doctor. She told us there was a chance our baby had full trisomy 18.
Denied an emergency abortion is being forced to leave the state to get one.
Texas bans abortions outright.
Continuing the pregnancy threatens her future fertility.
Ted Cruz says this abortion ban is perfectly reasonable. There's nothing reasonable about what my family went through. I had to flee the state for care. My husband and I were overwhelmed with joy to find out we're pregnant again. If I hadn't have fled my state, I wouldn't be pregnant today. Ted Cruz fought for this abortion ban, and the consequences have been devastating. Colin Allred will restore common sense to our healthcare laws and fight against a ban that's gone way too far.
That was Kate Cox in an ad for Colin Allred. Ted Cruz and Colin Allred recently debated, and like so many Republicans, Ted Cruz would not really state his position. Instead, he diverted attention, accusing Colin Allred of allowing women to have abortions in the 8th and 9th month of pregnancy. Donald Trump is constantly talking about that on the campaign trail. Here is Colin Allred.
It's time to finally tell the truth here. Senator Cruz just looked into a camera and lied to Texans about my position. Let's be very clear. You should look into the camera and speak to Kate Cox, who's watching right now, and explain to her why you said that this law that you said is perfectly reasonable, why she was forced to leave her two children behind and flee our state to get the care that she needed. Or look into the camera and talk to Amanda Zarosky, who's watching right now, and explain to her why it's perfectly reasonable that because she had a complication in her pregnancy and was denied care so long that she may never be able to have children of her own. Or to the 26,000 Texas women who've been forced to give birth to their rapist child under this law that you called perfectly reasonable. It's not. This is not freedom. I trust Texas women to make their own healthcare decisions. You know, Allie and I have had two baby boys here in Dallas in the last 5 years. You're scared the entire time. You don't know what they're gonna say. But I can't imagine if the doctor come in, said there's a problem with the baby, or a problem with Allie, but there's nothing I can do because Ted Cruz thinks he knows better. That's not who we are as Texans. When I'm the United States Senate, we'll restore a woman's right to choose. We'll make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again. And we'll make these stories of seeing these horrific experiences going on all over our state something of the past. That's my commitment to Texans.
Congressman, thank you. Senator, you did not directly answer the question I want to ask to you again. Do you support or oppose exceptions for rape or for incest? Again, asking as a Texan and as a father tonight.
So I want to be very clear. If you listen to Congressman Allred's answer, at no point did he make any reference to his own record. He desperately wants to hide from the fact that as a congressman, he voted to strike down Texas's parental notification law. He voted to strike down Texas's parental consent law. He voted to legalize late-term abortions, including the 8th and 9th months. He says he wants to codify Roe versus Wade, but that's not what he voted for. And I'll tell you what, tonight I suspect he's going to run away from his record on a whole lot of issues. We have a website. It's called allredfacts.com, allredfacts.com. Every time he gives an answer, just click on allredfacts.com, and we'll show you the exact vote he cast. Now, as for what the law should be in Texas, that's a decision that will be made by the state legislature. You know, Congressman Allred is running all sorts of ads saying that I made this decision. I don't serve in the state legislature. I'm not the governor. The folks that make the laws here are the state legislature and the governor. He knows that, but he's trying to deceive the voters of Texas.
I want to jump in here because I think it's too important.
We'll give you 60 seconds.
I want to be very clear to the people of Texas. I support the protections and the restrictions under Roe. But Senator Cruz just called himself pro-life. You're not. You're not pro-life. It's not pro-life to deny women care so long that they can't have children anymore. It's not pro-life to force a victim of rape to carry their rapist baby. It's not pro-life that our maternal mortality rate has skyrocketed up by 56%. That's not pro-life, Senator. So to every Texas woman at home and to every Texas family watching this, understand that when Ted Cruz says he's pro-life, he doesn't mean yours.
That is Colin Allred and Ted Cruz at a recent debate. John, you wrote a piece about this debate. What really stood out for you?
Allred was strikingly well prepared for the debate. And he didn't just hold his own with Donald Trump. I apologize. It's covering Trump too much. He didn't just hold his own with Ted Cruz. He overwhelmed Ted Cruz. There were many, many points where Cruz was kind of left, you know, mumbling to himself over at the side of the stage because Allred's presentation was so strong. And it was a stark critique of Cruz's record. So it's a very powerful debate. Remember, this Senate race in Texas is not at this point considered one of the top tier races, right? The focus tends to be on a group of Democratic incumbents, and the Democrats have not really expanded the race out to some of these other states, such as Texas. Although I think they're on the verge of doing so and beginning to do so. It's my view that if you watch that debate, you understand why Democrats would be wise to kind of make a big play for Texas, even though it has historically been a tough state for them. They haven't won a statewide race in Texas since 1994. The reason is twofold. Number one, Cruz is very vulnerable. There's just so much. We don't have enough show to talk about, all the things, all the baggage that he carries, including the fact that when the Texas power grid went down in 2021, he fled to Cancun, Mexico. Secondly, Allred is a very, very effective candidate. And frankly, is a roundabout way of me saying that if Democrats hold control of the Senate, i.e. if they keep a 51-49 majority, it will likely be because Colin Allred beats Ted Cruz. That's how important this race becomes for the Democrats, because it is, to my mind, the clearest route that Democrats have at this point to keep their majority.
And then there are a number of other races. In Wisconsin, you've got Tammy Baldwin, one of the few senators who supported Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill. What are your thoughts about the Wisconsin race between Tammy Baldwin and Eric, is it Hovde?
Hovde. Yeah. I live in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And so my mom and Eric Hovde's dad were the yearbook editors at East High School in Madison. So I've known the Hovde family for a very long time, my whole life. And Tammy Baldwin has represented me in the state assembly, in Congress, and in the Senate. And so most of my adult life, she's been my elected representative. So I know these people pretty well, and it's a fascinating race. It's one of those races where the Democratic incumbent appears to have the advantage. And that's because Tammy Baldwin's she's kind of a remarkable political figure. She's from Madison. She's very progressive. And yet she spent most of her Senate career outstate in the small towns, the small cities. She's been a huge advocate for manufacturing in Wisconsin, making her very close to a lot of unions, a lot of, working class folks. And so I think that gives her, she's got a little bit of a benefit there. She may run, as she has in the past, ahead of the ticket. And so Harris is a little bit ahead in Wisconsin. I think Baldwin's a little more ahead. But to give you an example, this comes, and I know it's almost like we're repeating the themes. Eric Hovde was further behind. And then Mitch McConnell decided the Wisconsin race might be very critical to building the majority. And suddenly at the start of October, something like $17 to $20 million came in for Eric Hovde.
Wow.
Just showed up. And the money factor is real. This is a very, very competitive race. And it's really ugly, too. I mean, the ads are very, very negative. And I think probably that's something we could do a whole other show on. I do think the intense negativity of the advertising in races like this in a state like Wisconsin actually turns a lot of voters off.
And then the important Maryland Senate race, WBAL fact-checked the debate between Democratic nominee Angela Alsobrooks and Republican nominee Larry Hogan.
My opponent wants to raise taxes on Social Security, which is not going to make things more affordable.
Social Security is a lifeline. By 2035, it's due to run out of money, and raising the cap for those who are earning over $400,000 to save Social Security is going to be really important.
Your entire campaign is based on, multiple things that are completely not true. I will support and will sponsor codifying Roe.
Sponsoring legislation codifying Roe remains to be seen, however. For more than three decades, Hogan has stated, although he's personally against abortion, he supports a woman's right to choose. He has consistently said the issue is a matter of settled law. He did waffle a bit in February when he said enshrining the right to abortion in the state constitution wasn't necessary. He now says he will vote in favor of the Maryland referendum question. In May of this year, he told the New York Times he's pro-choice.
What we know is that the former governor is a person who vetoed important abortion care legislation.
That is true. Back in 2022 as governor, Hogan vetoed legislation that would allow health practitioners like midwives and physician assistants to perform abortions after they've completed training. In his veto letter, he noted, the bill risks lowering the high standard of reproductive health care services received by women in Maryland.
I stood up for our families and held violent offenders accountable. As the elected prosecutor, I also lowered violent crime by 50%.
That is true. According to Prince George's County Police statistics, from the years 2011 to 2018, when also Brooks was elected prosecutor.
Crime is out of control, 500% increase in carjackings.
Without knowing the exact period of time he's referencing, the statement appears to be false. According to Prince George's County Police statistics, as of last year, carjackings are down 17% compared to this time last year.
And also vetoed important legislation that would have created a simple ban on ghost guns and would have also disallowed long guns.
That is false. The former governor did not veto ghost gun legislation. He allowed the bill to go into effect without his signature.
There's a very good fact check from WBAL-TV. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that race, John? Another very important race, and this one in Maryland.
Yeah, that's an open seat race. The incumbent senator stood down. He's a Democrat. Maryland's a very Democratic state. But Larry Hogan has proven to be one of those Republicans who's highly effective in running in a Democratic state, serving as governor. He's put a lot of distance between himself and Donald Trump, you know, made a big deal of the fact that he didn't vote for Trump in previous elections. And so, you know, he's trying the classic road of trying to be the moderate. And you heard that in many of his remarks. The complexity here is that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in Washington are pouring support into Larry Hogan because they only want one thing from Larry Hogan. They want him to vote to organize the Senate as a Republican-controlled Senate. That then gives them control of the committees. It gives them control of the nominating process for cabinet members, for judges, justices, etc. And so that becomes the dynamic. Is Hogan better than many other Republicans running for the Senate? Yes, he is more moderate. That is, I'm obviously using my bias, my parlance here, but he is a more moderate figure, and so that counts for some people in his favor. The challenge, though, is that, you know, if he were to win, that would absolutely assure that it's a Republican-controlled Senate. Also, Brooks she's a remarkably skilled candidate who has served with great distinction in top local offices. And so she's, you know, I mean, she's clearly ready for this race. And I think, as you heard there, she's a very effective candidate. My sense is that she's going to win this thing. Hmm. And one of the reasons that she's probably going to win this thing is because of the Kamala Harris factor. And this is something that's not put into the mix in analyzing a lot of these races. When Joe Biden was the likely nominee, the Democrats were in real trouble. It was looking very weak for them all over the country. There are many states where Harris coming in has really bumped up the Democratic numbers, bumped up the Democratic base. Maryland is one of those. And so my sense is that having Harris at the top of the ballot dramatically increases the chances that Angela Alsobrooks will win that race. But it's still a serious race and one that we're all keeping an eye on.
We don't have time to play this clip, but I have to mention it because it's just wild what you're hearing from these guys about abortion. So yeah. In Ohio, you've got Senator Sherrod Brown running against Bernie Moreno. He was Trump's pick. He's a wealthy Colombian-born businessman. And NBC4 obtained a video at a town hall in which Bernie Moreno, the Trump pick, accused suburban women focused solely on their ability to get an abortion. And he said, why would this even be an issue for women over the age of 50? I mean, yeah. The people were laughing in the crowd.
Well, it's been said, by the way, he's not the only Republican Senate candidate who said things like that. Mm-hmm. And not the only Republican candidate who said things like that. And, you know, I mean, look, reproductive rights is an issue for men and women. For, you know, people of, you know, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of experiences, and all kinds of ages. My mother is 93, and she can discourse quite wisely on these issues, let me tell you, from her long experience.
Wow, you're lucky, John.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, there's people who care. This is an issue of passion for people of, you know, every age. Mm-hmm. And Moreno in that Ohio race, and it's good we're closing off with the Ohio race, that is a really important race. In that race, you've got Sherrod Brown, who is one of the most experienced and kind of remarkable members of the Senate, somebody who's, you know, lived around the world, been involved in all sorts of issues, incredibly brilliant guy who's also very deeply, you know, in touch with Ohio over many generations, running against a guy who bought his nomination. I mean, that's the reality. The Republican nomination was bought in a primary, and who has virtually no experience. And it is really one of these fundamental questions. Can a state that's probably going to vote for Donald Trump elect a Democrat to the U.S. Senate? Do we have enough ticket splitting to make that possible? And Ohio's really going to be the key test on that this year. If Sherrod Brown can pull it off, it will be because, probably, some significant number of Trump voters vote for a reasonably progressive Democrat who happens to be very deeply rooted in Ohio.
And Ohio gave us J.D. Vance.
Yes, it's a very, very interesting pairing of U.S. senators there,
right?
At this moment. Yeah. Well, it's a battleground state, and right. And this is the thing to understand. Even, you know, as bad as Vance is, he often defers to working class issues, talks about them, tries to focus in on them because of Ohio. Brown is much more genuine in that regard, and really the core question is, can Brown's genuine commitment to working class people get him through this election?
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation, who's written many books, including his latest bestseller, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. As always, John, it's great to chat with you, and we look forward to having you again on soon. Thank you.
Total honor to be with you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. You can find John's work at KALW.org. Click news and then your call. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Tariq Ansari for engineering our show. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of Israel's war on Lebanon. And the latest with that, the government says more than 2,300 people have been killed over the past year. More than 1.2 million have been displaced. Then we'll continue talking about media coverage of the campaign. How are the media reporting on Trump's overtly anti-immigrant rhetoric and Vice President Harris's plans if she becomes president? We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.